Ready? Here we go. Here we go. Here we go. Grab a seat. Grab a seat. Grab a seat. Hey, hey, Daryl. Hey, Daryl. Love to do church, you know. Hey, welcome to Midtown 12 South. My name is Elliot. It's a joy to be with you this morning. If you're visiting, really glad that you're here. I know I've already met a couple people who this is their first Sunday here. It's lovely to be with you. We have four services at Midtown 12 South, and this is the 10 a.m. and maybe the best one, you know, 10 a.m. And there's June Jam coming up, which is the basketball tournament that's coming up. I had shoulder surgery, so you know if I do enter, if we don't win, that's why. But I had shoulder surgery like 4 weeks ago. I may enter a team. We'll see. But I love it. I love being with you. Love getting to linger with you pre and post service. It's beautiful. So lovely to be here. We are continuing on in our, basically our entire 2026 is our sermon series in the book of John. We are walking with Jesus at the pace of Jesus as we see how John presents him to us. And even non-biblical scholars, critical scholars would tell you the work of the Gospel of John is a masterpiece. That John is this writer who he weaves themes in and out, and he tells these stories, and then he organizes the text, and he weaves to this story, and then comes back to a theme, and he's painting this masterpiece. And so it's hard to say with one sentence, the Gospel of John is about this, like this one theme in the Gospel of John. There's dozens of themes in the book of John. One theme that we are unpacking this year, and it really is on every page, it really is in every story and every interaction and every teaching that Jesus does, every miracle he performs, is this reality that Jesus is a misunderstood Messiah. And it's easy to think, oh yeah, he was misunderstood by the people who rejected him and didn't believe in him. But what we see in the book of John is that even those that come to believe in him don't understand him. Even his closest friends, even his disciples don't really understand what he came to do. They don't really understand the kingdom he came to bring. They don't really understand that he was here to initiate a new kingdom, not to overthrow the Romans. Like, there's all this misunderstanding of Jesus. And what's amazing about it is not just that it's so common that he's misunderstood then and now. What's amazing about it is that Jesus, when he was misunderstood, didn't do what we do when we're misunderstood. Because the common thing to do when we feel misunderstood is to retreat. The common thing to do when we feel misunderstood is to reject those that misunderstand us, to get angry at them, to judge them, to look down on them. If you just thought like I thought, you'd understand like I understand. But Jesus actually never wavers from his mission, and he ends up hanging totally isolated on crossbeams because he was so radically misunderstood and so willing to continue to be misunderstood. That's our misunderstood Messiah. So at the end of this time, we want to understand him better for sure. We also want to see him for who he is, that what kind of Messiah is this, that even though he was rejected everywhere he went, he still came and he still did what he came to do, which is give his life for us. So we're unpacking this diamond. We're rotating this diamond around of all the ways he was misunderstood that we can see. And we come to another theme here of his misunderstanding in John chapter 8. Really short little interaction he has with these Jewish people in the crowd. We're looking today at misunderstood freedom. So this is John chapter 8, starting in verse 31. We're going to read 8 verses and then talk about it. Verse 31 of John 8 says this: "So Jesus said to the Jews who had believed him, 'If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free.' They answered him, 'We are offspring of Abraham and have never been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say you will become free?' Jesus answered them, 'Truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin. The slave does not remain in the house forever. The son remains forever. So if the son, capital S, the son sets you free, you will be free indeed. I know that you are offspring of Abraham, yet you seek to kill me because my word finds no place in you. I speak of what I have seen with my father, and you do what you have heard from your father.'" It's the word of the Lord. Amen. Okay, brief interaction that we're studying this morning. It's a part of a much larger interaction in John 8. We'll look at some of it again after this, next week, the next chunk. But Jesus doesn't pull any punches here. He comes right out of the gate and drops a bomb on them. This is how he begins in verse 31 and 32 and 33. Or maybe, let's read through 34. That kind of sets the scene for us. It says, so Jesus said to the Jews who had believed him, so they're starting to believe in him. They're like, oh, maybe you are who you say you are. They don't understand him, but they believe in him. If you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. They answered him, we are the offspring of Abraham and have never been enslaved to anyone. How is it that you say you will become free? Jesus answered them, truly, truly, I say to you, everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin. Okay, so Jesus says, you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. You don't say that to people who are already free. Much like you don't say showers help with hygiene to people who smell great. Like you don't need to say it to them. People have said it to me. I took a little offense to it, but Jesus is, when he says you shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free, what's he saying? He's saying, you're not free. I need to tell you how to get free because you are not free. And the crowd responds by saying, how dare you say we're not free? We are free. We're descendants of Abraham. Okay, Abraham, Father Abraham, he had many sons. I'm one of them. So are you. Maybe. I don't know. But they bring up this thing from like millennia past. They're bringing up their ancestry. They're bringing up their lineage. Why when Jesus tells a people you're not free, why do they go, whoa, 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 hold on. We're Abraham's kids. We come from Abraham's line. We come from Abraham's seed. And then they say, we've never been enslaved to anyone, which you want to go, well, hold on now. Do you know your history, Abraham's kids? If you go back through the Old Testament, which is where you hear the story of God's people who came from Abraham, the Israelites, the Jews, they spend most of their existence being enslaved to other people. In Egypt, they were enslaved to Pharaoh for 400 years, and then God, through Moses, sets them free. That's what the whole book of Exodus is about. And then Leviticus through Joshua is them living into that freedom and coming into the promised land. And they don't spend but a couple hundred years in the promised land before they're enslaved again to the Babylonians and the Assyrians. And they get taken captive into a faraway land. And now they come back to their homeland later in the Old Testament. And they're enslaved by the Greeks, Alexander the Great. And they're enslaved by Rome and Caesar. Like they are not a free people geopolitically. So they're not talking about, hey, we're a free people and no one's ever ruled over us as Abraham's kids. That's not true. Here's what they are saying. Hey, Abraham was our godfather. Abraham's the OG. We all trace ourselves from his line, and as children from Abraham's line, yes, our story does include being in captivity many times, but guess what else our story includes? Us being set free many times, because God's people are free people. We don't care who is ruling over us politically. We don't like that. We want the Messiah to kick Caesar off the throne for us, but we also know, hey, don't come at our spiritual existential freedom. Our very identity, their identity as a nation gets formed when they're leaving Egypt out of slavery and they become known in the ancient Near East as the people who God set free from Egypt. It's their whole identity. It becomes their confidence. And in their psyche, they believe this: Abraham is God's chosen people. We are God's chosen race and God's people are free people. Yes, we want a different king on the throne. We want one of David's sons to rule over us geopolitically. But existentially, ontologically, we're free. We're free spiritually. We're a chosen people. God has set us free so many times. And hey, we know Rome is ruling over us right now, but that the day's coming where we're going to be free again. Don't get at our identity as a free people. To be told by Jesus here, you don't know the truth, which means you don't know freedom, strikes at the very root of their assurance and identity. And Jesus loves them enough to tell them, you're not free. You are actually in spiritual and internal and existential bondage. I'm not talking about enslavement to a political or economic system like Rome. I'm talking about slavery to a rebellion against the God who made you and has freed your people many times. But your lineage, coming from Abraham's line, doesn't make you free. You are not free experientially, and you are not existentially free. And here's what I love about this interaction. And this is like a truism in life. Happens all the time. Ask any good therapist or ask a perceptive wife. not the husband. Ask a perceptive wife if this is true. Here's what happens in this interaction. Their response to Jesus, their response to the statement Jesus makes, proves the statement he made. Their very words to him, their response to Jesus, demonstrate the condition they're in. How they respond to Jesus so shows just how not free they are. It's like comically ironic, comically oxymoronic. Like Jesus says you're not free, and they want to respond to him, and how they respond to him proves what he just said. Happens all the time. Let me show you three ways from this text that their words reveal what he's talking about, and maybe we can relate. First thing they do is they get defensive. And them getting defensive is actually proving how not free they are. Because free people don't defend themselves. Like in argument. Free people don't have anything to prove. Like let's say they were right. Let's say in their claim, we are Abraham's descendants, therefore we are free because God's people are free people. Why did they have to yell at Jesus to prove that? If they're actually free, if they're truly free, they could have just let him have his opinion and not get into an argument with him. Free people don't have anything to prove. But they clearly are showing how not free they are by going, let's get into the courtroom and let me show you, let me prove to you that, let me bring out my examples and my evidence and my defensiveness. You don't know what you're talking about. It's like, okay, free person, you're doing great. Second thing, they get defensive, which proves how not free they are. They get arrogant. All these are interrelated. But the arrogant entitlement to their perceived and declared freedom is further proof that they're not free. Okay, if you're truly free, here's what you actually know. Truly free people know they have been set free and they don't deserve it. So truly free people are humble and not arrogant. And so here's what they're saying when they're yelling back at Jesus. We're Abraham's kids. This is our right. This is our lineage. This is our birthright. You can't have this. You can't take this away. This is mine. Actually shows how not free they are. Their ego is so exposed that they are proving how fragile their ego is, and free people have no ego. Free people are humble people. And then the last one, it comes out not in the verses we read. Verse 37 will tell us that Jesus knows that they're about to kill him, that they're plotting to kill him. He says, I know you're seeking to kill me. Jesus suggesting to them that they're not free sparks a deep rage in them. And that's the third thing that proves the statement. Their rage proves how not free they are. Apparently their freedom is so fickle that they want to fight to the death anyone that suggests otherwise. Like easily irritable in their freedom. A healthy response could have gone like this. Much like in the not getting defensive, healthy response could have gone like this. Jesus could have come and said, truth will set you free. And they could have said, I know, isn't it great? Like, isn't it great that the truth has set us free? Instead they go, we're gonna kill you, dude. Like, we want you hanging on cross beams. We want you executed for what you're saying. Free people are not easily threatened, but they are. So do you see how even their response to Jesus demonstrates what Jesus is talking about? Defensiveness, arrogance, and easily irritable, enraged with wrath. And would you this morning be courageous enough to admit that maybe in the places where we are defensive, arrogant, and enraged, maybe we're not as free as we think we are either? And is there anything more offensive to a Western human than to tell us, we aren't free? The place that our freedom creed manifests itself in us, like we don't claim lineage to Abraham. We do claim a little like lineage to a country, like we're American and all that, but it's big. It's way bigger than just America. It's way bigger than just like the land of the free. That is part of it for us in the room. where we would like get defensive and enraged and entitled about our freedom. But it plays itself out anywhere in the modern West. And the place that it manifests itself more than any other place is our death grip on this word, autonomy. Autonomy. Auto, meaning self, nomos, meaning law, self-law, self-rule, self-governance, self-kingship. I am in charge of me. And so the autonomous self is the self that creates their own value system. The autonomous self is the self that establishes their own norms and then is answerable and accountable only to the self. And this concept, since the Enlightenment, like the Enlightenment didn't invent the idea of autonomy, but it poured gasoline on it. Since the Enlightenment, it's become like the way of the modern West. And then we enter into modernism, and then we enter into postmodernism, which is where we're living now. And all that, philosophically speaking, has poured gasoline on the commitment to people of the West being deathly autonomous. It plays out in our marriages, it plays out in our communities, in our jobs, in our morality and ethics, in our economy, in our political ideologies. Autonomy has become synonymous with existence for us. David Foster Wallace, an author of last generation or so, gave a really famous commencement speech at Kenyon College about 20 or so years ago. He was not a believer at the time. I heard he came to faith before his tragic end, but he gives this talk called This Is Water, and it's all about how autonomous and self-centered the modern man is. And he titles the speech, I would love to read for you the speech, it's probably better than my sermon, but the speech is titled This Is Water. It's like, why do you call it This Is Water? Because he tells this little parable about two fish swimming by another fish in an ocean, and one fish swims by and goes, how's the water today, guys? And the other fish go, what the heck is water? Because you're swimming in it. You don't even know that this is the air you're breathing. It's like oxygen. That's what autonomy has become synonymous with existence for us today. Everybody, left and right, traditional and progressive, single and married, everybody has a deep belief in the need for autonomy, and everybody equates autonomy with becoming a better version of you, with your health, mental, physical, emotional, with your growth, with your freedom. Autonomy equals freedom. And the more you can live into your autonomy, we would believe, the more free we will be. The more autonomous I am, the more free I am, and don't you dare take away my freedom. That's how we think about it. And so here's what begins to happen living in the autonomous self, the self-law, the self-rule. I decide what's best for me, and no one can tell me what's best for me except me. I bring all the weight of demanding to have my own autonomy, and here's what it looks like. There's a mounting pressure that I feel in that living that I have to make sure I'm getting it all right. I have to have the right thinking. I have to have the right identity. I have to have the right job. I have to have the right spouse. I have to listen to the right podcast. I have to be in the right networks. I have to go to the right school. I have to vote right on all the right issues. I have to make the right amount of money. I can't not make the right decision for me, because what will that mean about my life if, as the autonomous person, I don't make all the right decisions? It's exhausting to be autonomous. But if you're ruling over you, you better not screw this life up. You better get it right so that you can maximize and actualize and self-protect and be totally self-dependent. That's the goal for all of us, isn't it? We all want to be self-dependent. I don't want to need anybody else. I don't want to need my family of origin. I don't want to need the man. I don't want to need the government. I don't want to need anything. I will take care of me. I will be totally self-dependent. And we love to believe that if we get it all right, not only will that give me a security, here's what else we secretly love about the quest to get it all right in our autonomy. We love the ability to look down on all the other people who aren't getting it right like we are. And so the pressure that we create in our autonomy is this. It's quite similar to bondage. This is what is so ironic about the quest for autonomy. In our quest for freedom, that we believe comes through autonomy, we actually become enslaved to it. We're actually not free. Because in autonomy, guess what? There is still a master to bow down to, the master of the self. Bob Dylan, gotta serve somebody. Jamie Smith, who's one of my favorite living authors, he's a philosopher and a professor up in Michigan. He says this, and this is a little bit longer of a quote, but it reads smoothly. He says this. He says, we have remade the human person into a protected and autonomous and independent self, free to determine our own good and free to pursue our own authentic path. We shut out the divine to carve out a privatized space to be free on our own terms. But we didn't realize the extent to which we were shutting ourselves in. Congratulations, modern man, he says. You liberated yourself by locking out transcendence. The price was sealing yourself in a cell. We thought we were our own liberators. Turns out we might be our own jailers. Do you hear what he's saying? Autonomy means you are your own master. Are you a good one? Like, you become your own ruler, and let's not even talk about like your qualifications to rule over anything. You're probably unfit to be a ruler. You're probably not fit to be king or queen. But let's just talk about the one person who you have decided to rule over, which is you. You treat your subject horribly. You're not kind, you're not merciful, you're not consistent, you're not just, you're not righteous, you're not stable. See, you and I thought that self-ruling would liberate us. It doesn't. We're actually not free on our own. And the Jews in their own way in John 8 and in the first century, they were autonomous too. Because autonomy comes from the Garden of Eden, Jesus would say. Like the garden where the fall enters or where sin enters, the picture is where like autonomy is in your bloodline. It's what Adam and Eve decided to do in the garden. And so we're not the first generation to be autonomous and declare our freedom. We're just the first one like on a global scale to believe like this is the best way all at the same time. But the Jews were being autonomous too in their own way. They made up the idea and the law, the self-law for themselves, that because they shared a bloodline with Abraham, were free. But they weren't. They were slaves to themselves. So speaking to an enslaved group, them and us, listen to what Jesus says in verse 36. But if the Son sets you free, you'll be free indeed. Please hear that declaration over against your own quest for autonomy and hear the sweetness of its sound. You want to be free? Do you want to be free? Do you want to be like really, actually free? If the Son sets you free, you'll be free indeed. This is such an affront to our self-rule and our claims of freedom. But Jesus is talking about a freedom that you can't buy and you can't achieve. There is a liberation you can't think or work your way into. It's the freedom of being set free by the Son and being set free from yourself. If the Son sets you free, you'll be free indeed. Did a little study on that word indeed, because it's not really a word I use a whole lot. Like, I don't say indeed. Indeedly, I don't say indeed very often, indeed. But it's an interesting word. And the Greek word that Jesus uses that we translate in our English Bibles as indeed, some translations say truly, you'll be truly free. It's the Greek word ontos, which is where we get our word ontology from, which deals with the nature of being, the nature of essence, like your truest self, like where your identity and your sense of self, your ontological self is like the nature of your truest essence, your actual self. Jesus says, if the Son sets you free, you will be ontologically free. Actually and truly, and in the fullest sense of yourself, you will be truly and holistically free. That's a massive claim. And he'll go on to say that the freedom he's talking about is freedom from sin, because he says anyone that practices sin is a slave to sin. And I know when you hear that word, if you grew up church adjacent, it gets minimized into this category of, well, sin is the bad things that I do, and that's true. But it would be helpful to not minimize sin's definition as just like the acts we do or don't do that we would call sin or not sin. Sin biblically is much bigger than that. Sin is the condition and the dominion that we're in. Like the reign of sin, like you are in bondage to a dominion. And it's not like, hey, maybe on these days, if I can like string along a couple days of not sinning, I'll be more free. It's like, no. You are like in sin before the sun sets you free. And what sin's condition and sin's dominion means is that we actually have to live in the narrative and the storyline that sin gives us. It's like meta, it's macro. There's a meta narrative encompassing the dominion of sin. And Jesus is saying, when you practice sin, you're enslaved to the dominion of sin. And so see, the irony with self-ruled people is not only that we're in bondage to our self-rule, we're in bondage to our autonomy. Living autonomously actually leaves us remarkably confused. It's a confusing dominion. Like we don't even know what to do in our dominion of self-rule, in the dominion of sin. Why does autonomy leave us so confused? Why does autonomy leave us so like disoriented? The late philosopher Alistair MacIntyre wrote a book called After Virtue. It's a profound book. But he says this, he says, I can only ask the question, what am I to do, if I have first answered the question of what story do I find myself a part? Let me read that one more time. I can only ask the question, what am I to do, like with my life, with my choices, with myself? I can only ask that question if I have first answered the question of what story do I find myself a part? And see, autonomy is not liberating because it wraps us up in a story that's too small to sustain a life and a purpose. The story of your little life being a quest for your own freedom that is yours by birthright or by your entitlement or what, however you claim autonomy for the self, it's such a small story, and to be honest, your little life is such a non-compelling story. I love you. It's boring. And if you're wrapped up in that story and that story only, you and I will be constantly tossed by the waves of any given moment or any given era or any given season trying to decide what am I to do. Like, I don't know. So I go insane because I don't know if this is the right path. I don't know if this is the right side of history. I don't know if this is the best possible solution to my discontentment. I don't know. I can't control the future. And just my little life feels lost at sea and trying to make all the decisions of what am I to do, because the story of what am I to do is wrapped up in the little story of just my life and my self-rule. Like when the story is written and directed and starred in by you, it's not just boring, it's exhausting. Because it's not a storyline big enough to sustain your life. Joseph Patton, who's one of our worship leaders on staff, dear friend, got to go to a Broadway show in New York a few weeks ago with his wife. And we were talking about this week, like this modern reality of autonomy and self-rule and my little story. And he said, you know what? Living autonomously, like the image that's coming to mind when I think of that, it would be the equivalent of when I was just at this Broadway show in New York. And if someone from the crowd had like run up on stage during one of the main pieces of the show and started trying to like belt out the song on their own. It wouldn't have been enjoyable for anybody. And it would have been a sign of how confused and crazy the audience member was. Because the show is not about them, but they're trying to make it be about them. Like self-focused, self-ruled lives make the story and the storyline all about us. And the plot line of your little life is way too small to make your life interesting. It's certainly too small to make your life make any sense. And it ruins the show for everybody else, quite honestly. And it reveals just how far from reality you're living. We're living. But if the Son sets you free, you'll be like actually free, like ontologically, existentially free. Because here's what he does when he sets you free. He sets you free from your little story and brings you into his cosmic story. And now your story is caught up in his story, and your little life is given deep dignity and deep purpose and deep meaning. And now you're a part of a story that can sustain your life. So the question of what am I to do that can only be answered if I ask first, of what story do I find myself a part? You've now got a bigger story than your little life. Now you can ask the question and mean it and find real wisdom in what am I to do? You find your place. You find your direction by wrapping yourself up in something that's sturdy, something that matters, something that's massive. And you don't have to rule over you anymore because the one that does rule over you has chosen to set you free. We sang it in our first song. It's just a song based on Galatians 5:1. It is for freedom that you have been set free. The Son has set you free. You're free to not only think about you anymore. Isn't that glorious? Like, doesn't that actually sound like liberty? You're free from yourself and free from having to hold your whole world together. You're free from having to be defensive or entitled or enraged. You are free indeed. And then when you're wrapped up into that story, guess what you'll do? You'll do something that is unthinkable in an age like ours. You'll submit your will to his. And here's why, because you know that's way more liberating than being your own master. Here's what you'll begin to do in this kingdom. You will, in your freedom, because the Son has set you free, in your freedom, you will then choose to stay with him. You'll choose it. You'll have the freedom to, and you'll go, I actually think in my freedom, that's what I want to do, because being with you is way more liberating than just being under my own rule. Jesus says it in our passage. True freedom comes from abiding in him. Look at the first two verses. Bob, you can throw this back up. So Jesus said to the Jews who had believed in him, if you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. Abide, remain, stay with him. And when you are with him, you will know how free you are. Because the Son has set you free. Story goes that Abraham Lincoln one day went to purchase a slave from the auctioning blocks before the emancipation. And after he purchases this young woman, he begins to loosen her shackles as they're walking back to his house. And he loosens her shackles and he says, you're free. I bought you, setting you free. And in disbelief, she looks back at him and says, what do you mean I'm free? Can I say anything I want to say to you? Because I've got some things I want to say to you. He said, you can say anything you want to say. You're free. She said, can I go anywhere I want to go? He said, you can go anywhere you want to go. You're free. And after taking a moment to herself in her new freedom, she thought, and then she said, then I think I'll go with you. Like, if you're the one that bought me and then set me free, what kind of human are you? Like, I want to be where you are. I want to be near you. I want to stay with you. That's what it means to abide in Jesus. He has bought you and he has set you free. It is for freedom that you have been set free. He has freed you from the cruel master of self and wrapped you up in a much bigger and much better story. And the way to live into that freedom is to stay with him. Stay with the Son, because if the Son has set you free, you'll be free indeed. Let's pray. Jesus, you say we're truly free. In many days, we don't feel like it. And so just in these next few moments, as we come and feast on your body and your blood that has set us free, Would that be a practice of abiding in you? Would that be a practice of believing that we have been set free into a bigger story than ourself? Forgive us for our claims on autonomy, Jesus, and help us to stay with you. We pray in your name. Amen.